Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Recovery Talk, a podcast from the Peer Recovery Center of Excellence. I'm your host, Shannon Roberts. Each month, we will be talking with an expert in the field, discussing substance use challenges, resources to assist individuals with a substance use challenge and/or their families, and best practices for the delivery of peer recovery support services. This month, we are bringing you another episode of Conversations with our organizational stakeholders. We'll hear from Crystal of Take Action Today, Dana of New Life 2, and Daryl of L'Etat Recovery Center. Stay tuned for stories from the field. And without further ado, let's get talking. Well, listeners, I am here with Crystal today of Take Action Today. Crystal, welcome.
Thank you.
Do you want to start off just by introducing yourself and talking to us a little bit about Take Action Today?
Sure. My name is Crystal Cantrell. I'm a certified peer recovery specialist. I am a person in long-term recovery, and for me, that means that I have not had the need to ingest alcohol or drugs since 2005 due to a 12-step program. However, I do honor multiple pathways when we try to assist people in their recovery, so I'm very open to that. I am currently the assistant director for Take Action Today. We are an organization that is quickly growing, and we got started in 2019 due to a community member in West Frankfort, which is where Mike Tyson, our executive director, is from, passing away as a homeless person behind a store, and prompted that a lot of people realized that there was a homeless problem and a substance use problem and not enough resources for recovery or to help people in that situation. So they gathered the community together to do a Thanksgiving dinner, saying that the community needs to do more. It doesn't shouldn't always fall on the government, you know, to help. We have to help our communities. And the response to that was so great that they actually turned volunteers away because there were just so many people and there was such an abundance. So Mike just continued that process, got incorporated as a recovery community organization in 2020. And basically, we are majorly funded by Substance Use Prevention and Recovery Division of DHS. Those are our main funders. And then we do receive some community donations as well as some sponsorships and things like that. Also receive a lot of help from the people in the community who donate clothes for our resource centers, food, blankets, things of that nature. So back in 2021, we hired two Recovery Corps staff members. Recovery Corps, I believe, is currently in Virginia, Minnesota, and Illinois. I'm not sure if they have any other locations, but so it was Mike, and then we had a female named Lee Browning and a male named Paul Tart, who came on through Recovery Corps. So that was Mike's staff. And I came shortly after that, a couple months later in January of 2022. And our slogan is still building the plane as we fly it, because we, like I said, have grown quickly. We know a little bit about substance use and recovery from that, and a little bit about homelessness. But Mike's originally a coal miner, gone executive director. I have worked in an office most of my life, and now I have this title of assistant director. And Paul and Lee have gone on to become certified peer recovery specialists, along with Mike and myself. They are now in supervisory positions, and we now have a staff of 18 versus 4 just in that short 2-year period of time. So we're very, very grateful to God for his favor on the organization, and hope to continue, you know, to try to be a part of the solution for those who suffer from chronic substance use and or homelessness.
Thank you for sharing all of that, Crystal. What do you think? So what did the organization look like when you came on board?
We had one resource center, which we were working out of, a place called J City Center for Hope, which is a retired pastor and his wife, who is still a practicing clinician. They offered to partner with us and have us share some of the space with them for our work. And so that was our original resource center, and that's where all four of us worked out of. Today, there are now seven resource centers. We have Jefferson County, Franklin County, Williamson County, Perry and Jackson counties, seven resource centers. Our resource centers actually have showers, washer and dryers, a place for people to just come in and sit down out of the elements, have a cup of coffee, some conversation. Most of them have TVs or music that we just have playing in the background. We also offer peer recovery services at those locations or just connections to care. What else, you know, what else do you need? Do you need, you know, gloves? Things like that, hats with the winter coming up. And once again, so we try our best to just meet people where they're at and try to get them the help that they're looking for. Resources down here in Southern Illinois, for those who don't know, are very sparse. We don't have really, I think we only have approximately 24 beds available that we would call like recovery housing. And we mainly have to take our people to Central Illinois because these beds are always full, which is a few hours of a drive. And still, even sometimes there's a wait list for those as well. So we're hoping that, you know, now that we've grown so quickly, we're hoping to now also try to work on getting into, you know, ways to help the homeless and ways to rehouse people who are seeking recovery. Because once again, we have to travel so far to get people there. And sometimes people stay and they do well, but sometimes they come back and they have no safe place to go to. And then it's almost like they're going through possibly relapsing into their addiction again and things like that. So we're hoping to do that next.
Just thinking about rural areas and where there's a real lack of resources, that's something that comes up a lot. I'm based in the Midwest, and so there's a lot of resource deserts, for lack of a better phrase.
Yes. And so I originally come from Chicago and did not realize how sparse the resources were down here in Southern Illinois and in these rural areas, because, you know, for my recovery, I had several 12-step meetings that I could attend. They also had recovery events like dances or spaghetti dinners, breakfasts, things like that, where you could just share camaraderie. They had recovery bowling. And so I had lots of opportunities to do fun, sober things and surround myself with like-minded people. Down here, not so much. You know, for instance, if I wanted to go to, let's say, a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, the closest one is 22 miles from my house. So can you imagine someone who's new in recovery, who's just trying to get that support, but has no way to even get to that meeting? You know, and sometimes people who live in these rural areas don't have the best internet either. So, you know, while there are, I'm grateful we have a lot of virtual opportunities, not everybody, you know, sometimes that internet doesn't always work right, depending on which way the wind blows. So
that's fair. Yeah.
So another thing that we're also trying to do, besides bridging gaps in, you know, just in the resources, we're also trying to bridge gaps amongst the people in the recovery field. You know, a lot of times, you know, I'm grateful that we have prevention in schools. I think that's necessary, especially now that children are experimenting with things younger and younger. And we're also finding out that, unfortunately, you know, they could put fentanyl inside of, you know, a vape, and a child may try a vape and end up, you know, being fatal. And so I know that prevention plays an important part in this. And I know that the clinical role plays an important part because I went through treatment. I needed that safe space where I didn't have any of those temptations so much. So I respect and value that. However, you don't hear a lot about what happens after that. I mean, there is life after treatment. So we're also trying to bridge those gaps to let people know that are in the clinical world or in prevention that, you know, we're here too. And you can refer people to us and we can work with people who are looking for recovery, people who are new in recovery. Maybe somebody's been in recovery for a while and they're just looking for a better quality of life, or maybe they want to work on a few things or find some more recovery activities in their life. So we look for people, you know, to come volunteer with us when we do outreaches and things like that. And there is a conference coming up in March of next year called the Southern Illinois Drug Awareness Conference. It used to be called the Meth Conference. So you can see that we've worked on some stigma. And so I was able to be a part of helping to rewrite their Save the Date because I reworded it to say things like for those seeking recovery. The word recovery wasn't in there so much. And so there's going to be portions where we have people at the table talking about the challenges, but then we're also going to have some workshops talking about the solutions that are currently going on and how much greater that could be if we all work together at the same table. So it's an honor and a privilege. This has always previously been mainly about the clinicians at the table, the treatment providers, things like that, healthcare providers. So I love it that we now have a seat at the table as recovery support and as a recovery community organization to be able to kind of let the other people that are going to come into this conference to see that there are things, you know, outside of after treatment that are available in our rural area here. So it's an exciting time for me.
Yeah, that's super exciting. And it's also just so huge because we all know that recovery is not treatment and that it's way more than that. And there's so many other pieces. And so why wouldn't you have those voices at the table?
Yes, yes. And I think sometimes just from some of the people that I've talked to that used to be on that side, and I have spoken to and I have asked some of those people, you know, what is it that kind of held you back or maybe why you thought this way? And it really was education. So one person who was a social worker that I was friends with kind of said, I was kind of in program mode where, you know, I see people an hour and then it's time for the next person. She said, so sometimes it was just more of, you know, the flow of it versus the actual connection. So she said, you know, we're not allowed to connect with somebody maybe as much as we could say with a sponsor in a 12-step program and a person in recovery, just due to ethics and things like that. But she also said that sometimes it's hard for people when you're viewing the person who comes in with a problem, sometimes it's hard to see them as anything but that. I was at a conference at what's called the Fletcher Group in Kentucky, and I heard that they're doing wonderful things for recovery that way. And I heard, and I think it was a gentleman from Faces and Voices who said it, I heard that he said, if everyone in recovery would identify themselves as being in recovery, whether that be, you know, whatever that looks like for you versus saying I'm an addict or I'm a former drug addict, even though there's spaces where you might identify yourself that way. He said, if you just approach everyone saying I'm a person in recovery, people will just automatically see you that way. Whereas if I say I'm an addict, sometimes they're not listening to anything else you say after that because they're just picturing the addict, the old person, which is, I'm no longer that person. It took a long time to recover. Recovery has given me the option to heal from my trauma. It also has helped me to get rid of some of the unmanageability in my life. So it's not just about putting the substance down. I actually have a quality life today. I have a connection with a higher power, whom I choose to call God. I can be a mom. I can be a daughter. I can be a wife and all these things. There is also Southern Illinois Recovery Network is also a spinoff of Take Action Today, where Mike and myself and a gentleman named John Wright from Comwell, who is a Ross coordinator. We started this group to kind of try to get everyone from a recovery standpoint at the table. So it's called Southern Illinois Recovery Network. We're planning to have a conference sometime next year as well. And it's going to feature recovery community organizations, people in recovery, maybe people from the different pathways who may want a seat at the table. But we want to show people what happens in recovery land in the community, for lack of a better term. And that's an exciting time as well, because once again, we did not have this opportunity not too long ago, from what I recall. So I just love it that people are being receptive. And we just recently had a banquet for Take Action Today, and we honored several community members and stakeholders who have kind of opened their arms to us, saying, you know, we have a problem here with substances and there's not enough help for people. And if they do actually want help, they have to wait, you know, X amount of weeks. So we honored a newscaster who always finds time to get a news crew out when we're doing something to get the word out about our community, because it's close to our heart.
That's rad.
We honored a sheriff who has allowed us to have what we call the recovery curriculum in the county jail. So that we can plant some seeds and give some education to people to let them know that life is possible after, you know, incarceration. And so we also have a mayor who was honored. We opened two new resource centers recently in November, and the Chamber of Commerce are part of our ROSC councils, which are recovery-oriented systems of care. So they said, hey, you want us to do a ribbon cutting for you? So that also just puts the word out there. And, you know, like I said, most people don't know. There's approximately 23 million Americans that suffer from some type of substance use or mental health issues. But you do not know, or do not always hear, that there are also 23 million Americans in recovery. And that's what we're here to advocate for, is that we do recover. And I also love it that, you know, we have not been allowed into a lot of spaces, but gradually we are making progress. We also are going to be starting in Illinois a what's called like a peer recovery advisory committee. Some peers are not receiving fair wages as a peer, you know, for whatever reason. We also have a lot of people saying they're recovery friendly workplaces, but not really sure what that means or how that can be. The peers at our organization are allowed, where we try to meet people where they're at, but still get the work done. And, you know, there's a lot of people that would not have been successful if they were at another agency that just had all those rigid roles. For people who may still be struggling and trying to get things together on their end. So it has been a group conscience that a lot of our staff are very happy that they've had the opportunity, and that they're not worried about that if they're going to be 15 minutes late, that they're going to get terminated because it was their third time or something like that. So we're also hoping to open doors in that way. There's just still a lot of stigma as well. And we're hoping to educate people that peer services meet people where they're at. I personally, like I said, I'm a 12-step person. That's how I found my recovery. So it took me a while to be open to some of the other pathways, because it was in my head that abstinence is the way. I tried some other methods. It didn't work for me. So today I have an open mind about that. But I do want to see people still get to that place. You know, I don't want to see people stuck in a medicated assisted recovery, but not getting back to that quality of life or what's the next step. You can kind of move forward. And so, like I said, it's just a wonderful opportunity that God has given me to be able to use my voice. You know that I like to talk a lot. So what better way, you know, than to share, you know, that peer recovery, sometimes meeting people where they're at gets them to a better place where they're making the decisions for themselves, not decisions being made for them. Let's face it, sometimes when people make decisions for you, that's not always the best answer. Sometimes we resist, and I don't want to be the reason that someone runs away and says, I don't want this. If this is recovery, I don't want it. I don't want to be that person that person goes out there and dies, you know, in their using or in their addiction. I've also recently networked with a few churches. We have a lot of faith-based organizations that really just think that, you know, Jesus or religion is the only way that you can recover. And so I have tried my best to let them know that if someone comes to your group and they are a little resistant, maybe they're afraid of God, maybe they don't have a God concept, maybe they're ashamed and feel God's mad at them because they were in their addiction, I ask them, if you would refer them to us, we can work with them to get them to a place that's receptive to that. Because once again, whether or not that person chooses that pathway, if they're not receptive, we don't want to lose them saying, oh, this isn't for me, you know, and just going out there to die alone. So, you know, I'm hoping also, like I said, that there's such a movement and a momentum down here in Southern Illinois. We've got so many community partners that are backing us up. And we celebrate life today. We celebrate recovery. But like I said, it does boil down to the people in the community that are also partnering with us. There are still a lot of people, like I said, that still have a little bit of stigma. But I really think it's only just because of education. We had another lady who I'm sure you may have yourself heard those people. So we had a lady who said basically, you know, well, those people, if they would just stop using drugs, they would. And, you know, I wish it was that easy. You know, right? I loved my daughter dearly. I just couldn't put it down. And so sometimes I will try when time is permitting to either say, can we talk a little more about this? Or can I share my story with you? Something else is Narcan. Not everyone realizes there's been some resistance to Narcan because people think it's only for drug addicts. Whereas at one of our outreaches, we had a couple come up to us, and I would say they were probably in their 50s. And the lady was like, we don't need that stuff. And I talked to the gentleman and said, you know, do you have elderly parents? And it just so happened that he had a mom who was in the nursing home, but, you know, they took her home on the weekends. And I explained to him that, you know, what if mom forgets that she took a pill? And or what if he had grandchildren? I said, what if the grandchild finds the pills? You know, I said, it's even effective on dogs. If grandma, you know, drops a pill and the dog eats it, I was like, it's good to have Narcan. And so he was really engaged in the conversation. She wasn't too happy about it. But I just told him, and I said, you know, if you don't want to take it, you don't have to. But let me just tell you that just by having it isn't going to hurt you. I said, let's just say grandson finds it and thinks it's nasal spray. I was like, it's harmless to him unless he's ingested opiates. And, you know, he ended up taking a couple Narcans. And then I heard him telling the wife as he walked away, kind of like, well, I know that you're probably not so open to this, but I'm going to keep it just in case, you know? And so I feel like that was progress. So sometimes it's just a matter of explaining to people the whole story.
Well, Crystal, I know we're already coming up on our time. Is there anything you want to share with our listeners who may, I don't know, be starting to have similar conversations with their community members and want to build something like Take Action Today?
Sure. Actually, would you like me to give out our main telephone number?
Yeah, that's great.
If anybody wants to.
That's great.
Okay. So our main telephone number is 618-212-3171. We're in the process of giving everyone a new extension number. But currently, you know, if you hit zero, you'll get me. So you can just leave a message asking for Crystal. And my boss and I do have lots of consulting conversations where we do have people saying, well, how would I do this? And what does that look like? Faces and Voices of Recovery is a great helpful tool. So are all the people at Illinois Super. You know, I can't praise them enough because they have helped us to become who we are today, in addition to our staff. I would just say keep an open mind. Sometimes the people who are a little resistant to what you have to say as a person in recovery is only resistant because there's not been a lot of people advocating for recovery. Remember, for a while, it was don't tell anyone in you're in recovery because then they'll know that you were an alcoholic or whatever. So it was shushed for a long time. But so now, you know, speak your voice, be heard, find like-minded people because there's power in numbers. And like I said, educate. Sometimes it's just a matter of people not realizing that you can recover, even if that's one small step at a time. We meet people where they're at. It's person-centered, you know, when we do peer services. If you want to work on, say, getting a job, but not so much, you know, relationship issues, that's okay. You know, we're here to work on what you are ready to work on. And so, like I said, we also can work with people that are still in treatment as far as like outpatient. We have had a lot of people say, oh, I didn't know I could have a peer recovery specialist and still do outpatient. Yes, you can. I didn't know that I could have a peer specialist and still be in smart recovery. And so, like I said, don't give up. If you are struggling with substance, you know, issues or homelessness issues, give yourself a chance. If you are still living and breathing, there is a purpose and plan for your life. You can recover. It may not seem realistic to you right now, but just take that 1 minute at a time if that's what it is necessary to get you to that next step. And you will be surprised how quickly, you know, those steps add up. I would never, if you had asked me if I would have ever expected to be coming up on 19 years in recovery, I mean, no, I would not have even fathomed a day in recovery, much less. But I try not to focus on the length of time. I try to focus on the little achievements every day because I'm still working on stuff, believe me.
Aren't we all?
Yes. Yes.
All right, Crystal. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. And I want to thank the Peer Recovery Center of Excellence for all their wonderful stakeholder meetings. It doesn't matter what state you're in, just networking with like-minded people. Like I said, those ideas can spread like wildfire. And thank you for all you do for the recovering community.
Thank you. All right, listeners. Well, I'm here with Dana Smith of New Life 2. Dana, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And it's an honor to be up here.
Yeah. I appreciate you making the time today. Do you want to start off with telling our folks a little bit about yourself, and then we can get into what New Life 2 is and does?
So, my name is Pastor Dana Smith. By the grace of God, I got 24 years off active addiction. And, you know, I'm also, still in the process of healing for the 24 years because, you know, there's a myth that, you know, I'm not going to speak for everybody that got lived experience, but there's a myth that I used to get high. And that's not why I used to get high. I didn't use to get high. I used to build up self-esteem, self-worth, to fit in, to stop the pain, you know, from different things that transpired in my life. And, you know, the trauma I used to lower the voices and stuff like that. You know, and so now that, you know, by the grace of God, like I said, 24 years off, now I'm dedicating myself and our RCO to give back to folks. Oh, and I'm also married to a beautiful, lovely woman named Evelyn Smith, Pastor Evelyn. And she also has lived experience. She has 20 years in lived experience. So we're putting her 20 years and my 24 years together. I'm from New Haven. She's from Hartford. She's seen different things that I've seen. And we're putting all that together and we're bringing it back to our neighborhoods and, just offering a different view about recovery.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And congrats to you and your wife. It's what a beautiful story. I love that you're doing it all together.
Normally, I would have went back and talked about growing up in New Haven and how this happened and how that happened and why I started using it. I want to talk about why I'm not using today. You know what I mean? And how I'm not surviving today, how I'm living life today, and how my wife is living life today. And then, some of the things that's happening through our RCO and some of the things that's happening through our recovery houses, just seeing people's lives transformed and people come out with a different mindset where they didn't have the spark. Well, they had a spark in their eyes, but it was like a pilot on a gas stove. But then by the time, not just our assistance, but with God's assistance and them putting the work in, that little spark became a flame. We got people talking about how now they're getting married, they own their first home, they're back with their kids and stuff. And, that's awesome. That's beautiful to hear them stories, because sometimes this job, this work could be very demanding. It could be very, self-sacrificing. And sometimes you wonder why you're doing it, because you look up, you think you assisted so many people, and you think the line got shorter. You look up, the line got longer, and you were like, oh, my God. But then you just keep digging in. And at the center here, like, we got people walk by every day, knock on the window, hey, and they open the door and say, hey, I just want to say hi, how you doing, if you need anything. And that's why we do what we do, because people may use, people may do whatever, but there's still people. That's, when I was using, that's what I did. That's not who I was. But I allowed the stigma and things to, people calling me this and that. And I really started believing that's who I was. But that's not who I was. Those are things I did.
Yeah. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit more about New Life?
Yep.
Where it began? And I know you all have several programs and you've already mentioned some of them, but what did the start look like?
So New Life started from I went to a Christian-based program, housing kind of thing. It was like, I stayed there for 2 years and that's where I built the foundation with God. But that's where I really started learning who I am, And out of respect for our pastors and stuff, when my wife and I left, actually, I met my wife there too. So when we left, we got married and we said, we wanted to open up a recovery house, because my pastor, God bless his soul, he had his way of running it, but on Sundays you had to wear a tie, a white shirt and a tie. That's why you never see me in a white shirt and a tie again. Not two together. You might see, but it'd be like 100 degrees in there. We got a white shirt on and tie, sweating and stuff. It's like, I'm grateful, thank you, but no. So when when we got married, we said we wanted to open up a recovery home. And we opened a recovery home, and we still have Bible study like he does. We don't have a church, but we still do the Bible study. But it's more casual. You come as you are. I don't care. Just have on some clothes kind of thing. But, because of the 2 years that we spent there, that we wanted to give back, and we wanted to do a different twist. So we opened our first recovery home in 2015, I believe. It's a two-family men's house, two-family house with 10 beds for men. We started as a sober house, but then, you know, God kept sending us different people. So we changed the name from sober house to a recovery house because people just recover from life sometimes, you know, especially like after when COVID hit, people just needed to settle down. You know, them globes you shake and you, the Christmas globe is like having a blizzard, but then when you set it down, it flirt. So we changed it from sober house to recovery house because a lot of we learned it even ourselves. We were shaken up and we just needed a place where we could sit, come gather our thoughts and get ourselves, you know, together and then move on in life. So we changed it from sober to recovery house. And now, you know, we've been running that since 2015. And we've seen so many people come through there, and we assisted so many people. And, you know, unfortunately, we lost some people. But that's how New Life, the recovery house, got started. And then after the recovery house, after that, we opened our first RCO. We opened that in, what is this, 2004? We opened that in 2002, I believe. 2002, end of 2001. And we took a lot of the stuff we learned from the recovery house and our own lived experience. And we got a nice little storefront downtown New Britain, 117 West Main Street. And we're like a hub for information and recovery here. A lot of agencies, stuff, organizations, we get a lot of their information here, so people treatment or stuff like that. But the good thing about it, we don't push treatment. We're firm believers in harm reduction. So, you know what I mean? So if people need information or want some things like that, then we assist them with whatever their journey and their path may look like. And we also do our own trainings. We have trainings like, you know, there's one organization that has recovery coaching. There's a few organizations that have recovery support specialists here in Connecticut. And we came up with our training. It's called Integrated Healing Facilitator. We talk about mental health addiction, harm reduction, systematic oppression, and language, things to that nature. So, and we also, out of our recovery center, we also do reentry where people are returning home. And we have a nice welcome home package for them. We also help them get hooked up to different services if that's what they needed. We support them with, you know, care packages, bus passes, information about family groups. Because a lot of times we see individuals come home, and what we've been noticing is, yeah, they need to get a job. They want a job. But the biggest thing they struggle with, like 7 out of 10 people tell us, they struggle with being a dad. They struggle with being a husband or a wife or a mom because they've been away. And now the kid that was 3 is now 7 or 8, you know. And, you know, it's a lot to come home and you don't know where you fit in your own home at. So, you know, we run some men's groups, some women groups. We want to start running family groups. So, so just want to get back to what was given to me.
Yeah, that's a long list of services. I'm sure your days are not dull.
That's what we do now. But we're just getting started. Started because we do collaborate. I mean, like, you know, when we say we do all that, like our main thing is recovery housing, right? And the recovery house, just look at the recovery house as a tree, and everything else we do is part of the branches from that same tree. Because we do not stray from recovery. We do not stray from that. Everything we do is centered around recovery. And a beautiful thing about, you know, recovery, whether it's from life, recovery from addiction, recovery from mental health, everything we do is centered around that. And, you know, the center and everything else branches off that. However, even a tree will break if it's too much weight, or a branch will break if it's too much weight on it. So we're not saying we do everything ourselves. We have relationships with a lot of organizations here in the city of New Britain. Like, we don't do any clinical work. But we have clinical folks that you know we could call on, or if somebody want to go to them, you know. So we're not doing all the heavy lifting. You know, we do what we can do. Right. Then we'll point you to in a direction where other folks are doing something that you might need that we're not doing. You know, because I learned in my journeys, and I'm still learning that, right. You know, you can't do this work or recovery.
Yeah, recovery starts in the community, not with the individual.
We always need somebody. So, because, like, you know, growing up, and when I was using, and even when I was, you know, looking to stop using, there was a lot of conditions and a lot of detoxes and a lot of places I went. But none of the conditions and stuff looked like me. You know, there was very few black conditions. It was a lot of black workers, you know what I mean? A lot of black support, like, you know, they staff that run groups or serve you lunch and stuff, but you know, the real clinicians and stuff, the real counselors and stuff, there was very few black. And I couldn't understand it, and I couldn't hardly relate, because I felt they couldn't relate to me. They didn't know what it was like to sleep outside. They didn't know what it was like to sit in the park on a nice day, and people think you're sitting there because the sun's out and you're soaking up sun, but you're sitting there because you don't have nowhere else to go. And you can't go on the block because you owe half the people on the block money. So, you know, when I started sharing my space and stuff, they couldn't relate. And then, you know, I was like, you know, this 90-day program is good and this 7-day detox is good, but I still got to go home. And there's people looking for me at home. You know, they may beat me down or something, and they may not kill me, but they beat me down. But then they make me work for them. And by working for them, that means I had to sell for them. So I'm trying to stop using, but I don't want to die neither, right? And I don't want to keep getting beat up. So guess what I did? I had to work for them and sell for them. And in the process of selling, now I got it on me. So what did I do? And a lot of folks couldn't understand that. So when we opened up the recovery house, that's when we first started forming relationships with, you know, the caseworkers. But we realized the caseworkers couldn't really do nothing because they had to go report to somebody, and their supervisor had to report. So I was like, you know, I'd rather be called Pastor Dana instead of Executive Director Dana. But then I said, all right, so they understand the Executive Director better. So I said, since I'm executive director in people's eyes, I want to meet with the executive director. I don't want to meet with you. You got to go report to them. And I want to meet to the person that gives the order, just like I do. So I started meeting with them, and I was like, you know, this is what we've been seeing and hearing from different folks about how, you know, there's nobody in there at top or that's, you know, clinician-wise that look like them. And then every time they get comfortable with one clinician, then they turn around and go in, and 3-4 weeks later, that clinician's gone. Now they got to open up to somebody else. So we started to, you know, working relationships with the agencies and organizations saying, you know, this is what we're learning from people in the neighborhood about why they don't like coming there or why they don't like opening up and stuff like that. And, you know, They started hearing us, and then they started, you know, implementing some changes and stuff like that. And you know, we still have a long way to go. But you know, some things have changed a lot compared to where we were. So that's how we started building relationships with different organizations and agencies. And we're still help developing different things, because we had a couple organizations come to us that got some peers working with them and for them. And they asked us what we assist with their peers, because they said, honestly, we're not doing justice with our peers that we have hired. And it took a lot for them to say that, you know. So we're working with some of their peers and even some of their supervisors as far as, you know, trainings and things like that on with peer work. So we're also doing that. And then we're also working with peers as us, people with lived experience, we're working with each other to remind each other that it's not just about a job. We're part of a movement. We're part of a peer movement. And there's people that went through all kinds of stuff in order for us to even get to where we are. And we have to remind each other that this ain't about us getting a job of $20 an hour. This ain't just, this started when the peer movement started, was birthed out of civil rights or along with civil rights. And it's about people being treated fairly and equally, about getting a certification, because a certification don't validate my lived experience and it doesn't validate your lived experience. And that's what we want to remind not only agencies, but we want to remind ourselves. It ain't about just, you know, getting the certification. It's about treating each other fair and right. And the very things that we were fighting for back then, the same things we're still fighting for today: decent wages, decent housing, decent medical, and stuff like that. And, you know, some, you know, we're about reminding each other that, right, you know, this is bigger than us. We're still part of a movement. Then that's the peer movement. That's a civil rights movement. That's whatever you want to call it. And that's what we do. And that's why we have our RCO center here in downtown New Britain, to remind, you know, people that, you know, right, yeah, we'll offer you training, but, you know, with that training comes responsibility, that it's not just about you.
That's
getting
such a critical
job, it's about
piece.
You representing the peer movement.
Yeah. You
know, to keep it moving. That's where we're at. That's where we're at right now. So, I mean, we got a lot of work ahead of us.
Yes.
It is because somewhere along the line, we got lost in the money and we got lost in the certifications. You know, the mental hospitals and the institutions and stuff wasn't thinking about money or certification. And the people on the civil rights at the counters and stuff wasn't thinking about money and certification. They were thinking about being treated fairly. Just because I have something going on with me, don't judge me by my diagnosis and things like that. You know, I'm a person that needs some assistance, and so assist me.
Just tell me, what do you see for New Life's future? Like, what do you want this? What other work do you want to be doing? What do you see 5-10 years down the road?
I'm glad you asked. So we're definitely gonna have more recovery houses, men and women, different kind. And we wanna go, so like our trainings and stuff like that, we developed it for, you know, our neighborhoods, Black and Brown, but we also developed for churches, because churches have a lot of outreach going out there. And if you're going to go out there, then you need to know the proper language and stuff like that. So we want to like set up, help set up, not set up ourselves in different. Every city has a neighborhood. You know what I mean? So we want to go to New Haven, let's say, and not try to set up a New Life in New Haven, but support and educate the folks that are doing the same thing we're doing in New Britain. And they're doing in New Haven, want to help them set up an RCO in New Haven, right? And help them assist them with the trainings and stuff like that. So, because I, even though I grew up in New Haven, I don't know New Haven like I know New Britain no more. But there's folks that know New Haven just as well as I know New Britain. So now we want to equip them, help them, like, you know, properly do the work, teach them educate them how to do some grants and stuff like that to be self-sustaining. Like, okay, give a man a fish to eat for a day, teaching a fish, right?
Right.
Eat for a lifetime. But we also want to give you a fish. We want to help you. We want to teach you to fish. But we want to leave you the fishing poles, the tackles, the rods. So this way you ain't got to wait for us to come back. You know what I mean? But we will leave a catalog saying if you run out of these things, here, you could go online and order some more. You see what I'm saying? So a lot of times people want to teach you something, but they don't want to leave you proper equipment. So you got to keep coming to them, coming to them, coming to them. No, we want to build you up so you can help build up your neighborhood. You know what I mean? And then we're moving on to help build up another neighborhood because you live there. You know what your neighborhood needs. We don't know. Every neighborhood is different. Just because I live in New Britain, like, the North End is different from Arch Street. You know what I'm saying? So we want to just help equip folks in how to start an RCO, how to do some grants, do some outreach, reach out to your council people, your mayors, and form a relationship with the messes in the fire department, form a relationships with with the agencies and organizations that are in, right there in your neighborhood, and build a relationship with them so all the work ain't on you. Because we're also working with the police, the EMS up here, because we believe we're the first responders, right? We're trained, we have lived experience and stuff like that. So why aren't we part of that? Why aren't we part of that? And you know, and you're coming in our neighborhood, but once again, most of the officers and the clinicians that are coming out in our neighborhood don't even look like us. So, you know, everybody's in the equity and inclusion, but it's only equity and inclusion when it suits or when it's for a grant. So, but this is our lives. These are our mothers. These are our fathers. These are our sons and daughters and nieces and nephews. You understand? That's why we're equipping with our trainers. We're equipping. We're giving you the fishing pole, the fishing rods, the tackle, the bait. We're even giving you, when you run out, here go 10% off card. So you, when you go get some more, you get 10% off. You know, we're just about building up our neighborhoods. We're about building up our neighborhoods because we've been taught for so long, when you get a certain amount of money or when you make it, so-called make it, to move out. No, well, we're re-educating folks. When you do make it, then bring somebody else up with you. Build up your neighborhood. Because it can look just as beautiful as that community you want to move into.
Right.
And I'm a firm drug dealers, drug user, because I was one, and I was both, actually. There are people that need assistance, too. There are people that are hurting, too. The street workers, they need assistance, too. Yeah. Everybody's going through something right now. Instead of looking at the diagnosis or the label and stuff like that, let's get to know the people, the person. And then you find out that person is totally different than what you perceived up in your head. So we're back to bringing that humanity. We're back to bringing that human touch back. You know how you get on a phone and they say, press 3 for this, press 3, and you got to keep repeating yourself. Well, it's nice to hear a human voice on that.
I love that. What a great analogy.
Recovery and life is not one size fit all.
Mm-hmm.
New life is like your neighborhood tailor. You come in, it's custom made for you. It's, tell the truth though, it is, right? Now we like I said, you know, we're just, New Life is just getting started, and we firmly believe in partnerships. So if you're in a neighborhood and you want some assistance, we'll be glad to, you know, call us, reach out to us, newlife2.org, or my number is 860-371-8271. You know, just give us a call, because I know we're not the only one feeling like this. We can't be. And it's time for a change. And the only way our neighborhood is going to change it if we change it. But now's a good time for them to educate us and us to educate them. Yeah. Thank you. And I just want to say, if whoever prays out there, please keep us in your prayers for strength and wisdom.
Well, listeners, I'm here with Daryl Keim of L'Etat Recovery Center. Daryl, thanks for being here today.
Oh, you bet. I'm excited, Shannon. These things are fun.
Good. I love the energy. Do you want to get started with just introducing yourself to our listeners?
Well, like you said, my name is Daryl Keim. I am the current executive director, and in fact, I'm the founder of the L'Etat Recovery Center in Moscow, Idaho. Probably interesting to know a little bit about Moscow, Idaho, because we're a rural town. But I found whenever I say the word rural, you know, somebody from New York thinks that Chicago's rural. So I found it always helps to define rural. And in my case, I'm in a town of about 30,000 students in a county of about 45,000 people. And we're home to the University of Idaho with about 10,000 students. So 30,000 people in a town with 10,000 students.
Okay. Always appreciate context.
A kind of a small, remote little area about an hour and a half south of Spokane, Washington.
Got it. Well, tell me a little bit more about the Recovery Center.
Well, we were founded in 2015, and we were founded basically to copy what the Connecticut Communities for Addiction Recovery are doing over in Connecticut. And at that time, what that meant was we were founded to offer a recovery community center with a space for meetings and to do recovery coaching. However, where it gets interesting is what we've added since then. Because we're so remote, we found that we're kind of a central hub for recovery in Moscow, because there was nothing else before us that was really central like that. We had decentralized efforts like Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, but we didn't have one central hub that tried to be the face of recovery in the area. So, like I say, founded in 2015 to offer recovery coaching and some meeting space. And since then, we've really grown. In fact, I think last month we did 100 recovery coaching sessions. So we're still doing that. We've we offer about 25 different life skills, support group type meetings every week, which when you think about it, for a tiny little community of about 30,000 is pretty good. We offer, this is where it starts getting interesting. Since we have the University of Idaho right here in town, we also have recently started a student branch that we call Vandal Recovery, because the University of Idaho is the U of I Vandals. So we're basically trying to copy what we're doing down here. We're on Main Street. We're trying to copy what we're doing on Main Street up on campus, because we found that students have a slightly different need. Students want to meet with students. Students aren't necessarily recovery oriented. They are more harm reduction oriented. We just found some differences.
Sure.
So we found a location on campus for a campus outreach, and it's grown very quickly in the past year and a half or so. We also have a L'Etat County Jail reentry program where we go into the jail with a case manager and a male recovery coach and a female recovery coach. And we do what we call a day one program. So we find out who's going to be getting released in the next couple months. And we start trying to introduce ourselves to them while they're in the jail. And then on the first day that they're out of the jail, we have our day one program where we take them around to local resources, make sure they know what local resources are there for them. And then we have a small budget to help them with the first month's rent or buy any suit of clothes so that they can get a job, you know, necessities like that. And then we also partner with another group. And with, you might want to come back to this, because I found in our rural environment, us doing things doesn't always work, but us partnering with other groups works great. So we partner with another group that actually provides this program in our facility, but it's a group called the Rural Crisis Center Network, and they have a very unique crisis center model that they offer, in that it's open and available. It's available. I shouldn't say open. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year, but it's only open when needed. So it's not fully staffed at all times or anything like that. If somebody comes in and needs to access crisis services, we don't have a counselor available right away. Instead, we're part of a network. We call into a central dispatch number and say, hey, we've got somebody in crisis. And they bring a counselor down and some other staff within about 30 minutes to 45 minutes. And we're able to offer crisis services, which is really cool because, like I say, it's part of a network. So there's some others in the area that are also partnered in with the Rural Crisis Center Network. So we're able to keep people close to their community, close to their family, close to their support networks, and still offer crisis services, which is different from the traditional model. At least here in Idaho, crisis services tend to be a bricks and mortar building. And there's maybe one in each region of the state. And Idaho is a huge state, so you might be 1-2 hours away from you if you're in a remote area.
Yeah.
But this way, we're able to have one pretty close to everybody within our region, within maybe a 45-minute drive rather than a 3-hour drive.
Right.
And since it's in the regional hubs, most people are pretty well served by it, which is pretty cool. And then we partner with another group to provide harm reduction. So we partner with name's not going to come to me right now, but it's an AIDS-related group out of Coeur d'Alene. I'm sure it will come to me as soon as we're done here. And they help us provide a syringe exchange, naloxone distribution, condoms. We're able to do all that for free for people, which is pretty remarkable in very, very conservative Idaho to be able to pull that off.
No kidding.
And then two more programs that we've got. We partner with Oxford House, or at least we did partner with Oxford House, and I plan to again, on a men's sober house. Now, I say we partnered with them because we had a house fire and we're currently repairing the house.
Oh, no.
But we'll be running back out to them as soon as it's repaired.
Cool.
And then the final thing we do is we have a radio show and podcast. We call it Recovery Radio, where we've got a guy by the name of Johnny who's in recovery himself. And he interviews folks in recovery, talks about the AA steps and other aspects of recovery. Been doing it for years, so he's had all kinds of topics over the years. And that's a couple times a month he does that.
That's super cool. I love that.
The main programs that we've got. But yeah. It's enough to keep us kind of busy.
Yeah, no kidding.
What questions do you have?
I'm curious. You already said it, to go back to these partnerships, and I think I just recorded earlier with someone else who runs an RCO in Connecticut, and he said the same thing, that we know we can't do this on our own, and it's all about collaborating with other agencies and their expertise, again, to provide the folks seeking the service everything that they might need. Can you talk to me a little bit about like what building those relationships looks like?
Well, it's kind of varied. In the case of the harm reduction program, that's the North Idaho Alliance of Care. Told you it would come to me.
Nice.
And that one was pretty much a cold call on our part because they're not in town. Mm-hmm. So Coeur d'Alene, where they're at, is 75 miles or an hour and a half drive north of us. So they were looking to try and provide services in this area, but they didn't know anybody. And I had an incident happen that caused me to want to look into that, and I'll describe that momentarily. So in this case, it was simply a cold call up there saying, hey, I'm aware that you guys have things like safe syringe boxes, you know, syringe disposal boxes, and I'd like to talk to you about that. And they said, well, we've got a lot more than that. How would you like to find out? Here's our whole shopping list, so to speak. I had air quotes on that for you listeners. And I looked at it, brought it to my board, and said, hey, these folks have some interesting stuff. We should look at that. And that's how that one started, was a simple cold call. But most of the relationships we have are with more local businesses and local entities like our Latah County commissioners, local funders, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that's generally a bit more of a careful dance than a cold call.
Yeah,
that's being dependable over the years, doing what you say you're going to do, and holding true to the promises you make to them over the years, too. And I'll give the Latah County Commissioners again as an example there. They have They've been very supportive of us from the start. They saw the need from the start. They in fact, were part of the statewide effort to get some recovery community centers located in Idaho. Came from one of their commissioners. And so when I went to start this effort, that was one of the first things I did, is I reached out to them to say, hey, remember that Connecticut group you toured a few years ago? We're trying to do that locally. And I started meeting with one of the commissioners, a guy by the name of Tom Stroshein. And just, he got involved in the very start of our organization. He was on the committee that made it happen for several years. And that's been a matter of just always honoring our word to him. You know, if we say this is how we're going to spend the money you've donated to us, damn it, that's how the money's going to be spent, come hell or high water.
Yeah.
And if we're aware there's going to be a controversy that might come up that they might hear about, we give them a heads up. Hey, this has popped, and you should know that you might see this in the paper or your name might get brought in. We want you to know now in advance. So it's a matter of honoring friendships and just slowly growing a relationship. Mm-hmm. And they're a great example because, like I said, they've helped us. NRV, by helped us, I mean funding, I mean advice, I mean all kinds of ways they've helped us from the start. And it started out with advice, then it turned into advice and funding. And then a few years ago, as our partnership grew, we had coronavirus funds came into town. You know, uh-huh. I call them Biden bucks sarcastically, but they had a bunch of money that needed to be spent on recorded efforts. So they helped us buy that sober house that we talked about a minute ago. Because they were like, that money's specified for recovery, and it includes drug and alcohol recovery. So we like your effort. Let's do that. We'll help you buy half of that house. So nice. It grew to that. And then about a year ago, it also grew to the Latah County Jail Reentry Program. Because they've been satisfied with the efforts that we've been providing them, doing our best to, like I say, honor our word with them all the time. And they had more recovery-related funds. They saw, well, in this case, they saw a grant that their county grant writer could go after with my help. And we went after that to get the reentry program going. We wouldn't have been heard at the state level being a small recovery group going after that grant. But since we were partnered with the overall county, it showed we had the relationships we needed to be able to provide what was required in the grant. So relationships, like I keep saying, it's just all about slowly building and honoring what you say you will do and being straightforward.
Yeah.
And we found that with the Latah County Fund, biggest example. But we've partnered out with other folks. Well, here's another recent example. It's just a small one, but it's all about being seen in the community and growing in the community. And that is our harm reduction program, naloxone distribution, the naloxone distribution aspect of it. We recently bought a couple of, basically they look like an old style newspaper box. You know, uh-huh. You plug your quarters into them, you open the door and you pull out your newspaper. So for these are the free newspaper version of them. Uh-huh. We got them branded for naloxone distribution in those around town. So we got a couple of those boxes and we're partnering with local businesses. To, like right now, we've got one right outside of a large local grocery store called the Moscow Food Co-op, where it's a naloxone distribution box. And people can just grab the naloxone out of there for free. We also put condoms in there. And that's also a small example of how we're partnering, in that we're intentionally placing that at local businesses so that they've got a part of what we're doing and they feel involved and invested in what we're doing. And it surprises people because they don't expect naloxone distribution boxes just pop up in random parts of town, which uh-huh. For me, I think that's great because the problem's everywhere. So the solution should be everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
And then we also partner. Yeah. And then we also partner just with local citizens in both fundraising efforts. Now, for instance, our largest fundraiser is coming up, and we just invite people to come hear about us, buy them a free breakfast. They give donations. We'll probably raise about $40,000 that way from local citizens, which then become, because once somebody becomes a donor, they become what? They become a partner, don't they? They're now invested in your organization, even if they only gave $10, $20, $100. they now have some investment in the organization and they're a bit of a partner.
Mm-hmm.
We also, in the last several years, we started putting out signs. We call them don't give up signs. And what they have is their yard signs, like a politician might have. But on mm-hmm. one side, they say, don't give up. Then on the other side, they have some sort of recovery-related saying, like, it gets easier or something like that. So
mm-hmm.
we have about 100 of those that we place around town during National Recovery Month and also National Mental Health Month. And again, those are placed in different people's yards just as a way to get out there and be seen and kind of partner with them to so they feel like they're bought into our program.
Yeah. I kind of want selfishly, because I also, one of the hats I wear is on a local Kansas City harm reduction project. How do you all, so I want to go back to the harm reduction partnership. How do you all keep those naloxone distribution boxes filled?
So we've only been doing that since January, but so okay. far it has worked in that what we do is we go out about twice a week. We have about 7 or 8 doses that we put out at a time so that people don't come in and just take them all.
Sure.
And we haven't had that happen yet. So far,
nice.
Every time we've gone there, there's been 1 or 2 doses left in the box, which tells me people aren't just grabbing and running. Mm-hmm. And I think it probably helps that there's really no street value to naloxone.
Fair, yeah.
So I think that's a big help. But that's what we've done so far is, in this case, the placement of the first box at the Moscow Food Co-op is only about a block and a half away from our main office. So we literally just walk down there once or twice a week with a bag full of naloxone, some condoms, and drop them off. And we document that, of course. We track everything we sure. do here, as I'm sure everybody does. But the plan is, as we get it more out into the community, when we check it out to a business that's further away, we'll also check out, I don't know, 20 or 30 boxes of naloxone to them.
Mm.
And then just have them fill the box on a weekly basis. And then let us know when they need more.
Gotcha. Have you ran into any, and this can be a broader question, not specific to naloxone distribution or harm reduction, but just in building the relationships with the community, have you ran into resistance where folks are just not interested or just not buying your message? And how do you navigate those conversations?
I want to preface everything I say with, it really hasn't been bad. And it hasn't been bad at all, considering Idaho is one of the, I think I recently read a rating of how conservative states are, and Idaho is like number 6 most conservative. So we're mm-hmm. intensely conservative. That said, the objections haven't been bad over the years, but I've run into them at every stage when we've developed a new program.
Sure.
2014, when I was looking to place our recovery center, you know, we were copying CCAR, Kinetic Communities for Addiction Recovery. And one of their sayings was they were taking recovery out of the church basement and putting it on Main Street. Well, we're 531 South Main, so we took them kind of literally at that. But we probably looked at 30 different locations around town at the time. And most of them, we just crossed off the list. You know, we didn't think it was appropriate. But there was probably a quarter of where they heard what we wanted to do and they refused to talk to us or they stopped talking to us.
Mm.
That sucked. But, you know, at least we got a landlord that really wanted us out of it in the long run. And then when we announced our location was going to be downtown on Main Street, you can imagine that there were comments about we were going to be putting those people on Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
And God bless him. I love our mayor that we had at the time, because they went to him and complained and said, you should not allow this to happen. And he looked at him and he said, there must be 20 bars on Main Street. Why can't we have a place for folks that don't want to drink? Love that.
Great question. Yes.
So we're on Main Street. Our landlord happens to be a service club that kind of use us as an outgrowth of their own service, because we've got some similar missions to them. But we've been in the same building since 2015. Did we bring those people downtown? No, they were already downtown.
Right.
So we had it then. The next time it really popped up was when we went to buy a house. Because if you're not, those of you that aren't familiar with the Oxford House model, they like to be a nice house in a nice neighborhood. They like residential neighborhoods, what they're all about. And they are kind of I call them a 3/4 of the way house, and I'm describing them, because they don't have a live-in manager. Instead, it's all elected positions, and it switches out over time. Great program for folks that aren't familiar with it. I recommend they look into it. But we had folks in the neighborhood that were concerned. We had a lawyer come after us. And he was like, "That you're within 1,000 yards of a school," I think is what his angle was. And he was like, "Yeah, but our folks don't have any restrictions on where they can live."
Right.
And Oxford House has gone to the Supreme Court, and it's been defined as meaning the federal definition of family. So, Mr. Lawyer, what are you saying here? Our people can't live someplace because you're saying so?
Right.
So we had to fight against that. Of course, he did his job well. He's a good lawyer. And he got the neighborhood all riled up with petitions and things like that. And we just kept our heads down, tried to be as informative as we could about what we were doing, and pointed out that we had every legal right to, and we were going to try and be the best neighbors we could as we built into that neighborhood. So we had it then, most recently with our naloxone boxes. I've only heard one complaint, and it was on Google. So Google reviews, you guys can look it up if you want. The guy got on there saying that we were a horrible California-style nonprofit that was something along the lines of aiding and abetting the druggies and those people downtown with, I don't even remember, but we should go back to Washington. Well, I've been in Idaho for like 30 years. I think I know what Idaho is all about. Never lived in California. And frankly, if he doesn't like harm reduction, he should take that up with the state of Idaho, because they're the ones that legalized it. We're simply offering a program that's legal in the state of Idaho.
Right.
And really, naloxone? Come on. How's that? Right. Only thing that enables you to do is breathe.
Right.
So, point is, we've had a little bit of it at every stage, and the answer to it has always been openness about what we're doing.
Uh-huh.
This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. You're free to agree. You might think for whatever reason that harm reduction doesn't work. We think that it probably does based on 30 years worth of studies. So we think it's worth trying.
Yeah.
You might think an Oxford House doesn't work. We think based on 40 or 50 years worth of them working, it's worth a try. Sure. And by the way, as long as you're complaining, why don't you give a suggestion that we can consider? We might implement it too. So, yeah, basically, it all comes back down at the local level. What we try and offer all comes back down to an informal slogan that we adopted. And that is, and this is an informal slogan. I have it on my staff mugs, but people don't get to see this. We have a little Latin saying, Dukakis non solum loci. And what that means is, do shit, don't just talk. It's a
I love that
translation. And that's, like I say, it's just staff. We don't share that too much, but the staff get that, because I want them to come to me with new ideas. Every one of the things that we talked about, aside from starting the center with recovery coaching, one of my staff came to me and said, "Hey, we should look into doing this." I'm not all that creative, but I can certainly look at programs, analyze them, and decide whether they're worth implementing or not. So that's the default mode I try to inculcate into my staff is do shit. Don't just talk about it. Do it.
And I love that model of just also empowering your staff and letting them take ownership of the center and the programs too. Makes so much more sense than, yeah.
That's right.
Well, Daryl, I know we're coming up at the end of our time, so I just want to open it up to you the last remaining minutes. If there's anything else you want to share with our listeners, the floor is yours.
Nothing big. The biggest thing is really the whole thing I wanted to talk about with this was the importance of partnerships, at least how important it's been for us. And I think I've bored people for half an hour talking about that. But it's really been what kept us going this whole time was anytime we've had a problem, and we've had some major problems, it's been going back to our partners and saying, here's the problem we're having right now. Can you help us with the solution? And they found the solutions. This is how important partnerships are. I can't give any detail on this, but I had somebody contact the chief of police trying to get them to close us down. The chief looked at what we do, looked at our records, looked at the person who was trying to get them to come down. And this person wanted to literally lock us out of the facility.
Well,
so you know there's a big story here.
Right.
The chief simply looked at us, said, you know what they're doing on Main Street? I'm very familiar with their program. I'm not going to do that. And we stayed open.
Nice.
That's how important partnerships can be. They can complete save you if you're open and people trust in what you're doing and they know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably all I've got to say, unless you've got questions for me.
No, I think you said it all very well. And I think it just also harkens to recovery itself, that it starts in the community, not with the individual.
That's so wise. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you for connecting with us, listeners. Our goals in sharing stories and information is to provide hope and resources to the field of peer recovery. Please join us again next time on Recovery Talk. You can find our episodes on our website, peerrecoverynow.org. That's peerrecoverynow.org, or wherever you find your podcasts. The Peer Recovery Center of Excellence is funded by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration to enhance peer recovery support services by expanding access to training and technical assistance across the country. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official policies of the Department of Health and Human Services, nor does mention of trade names, commercial practices, or organizations imply endorsement by the U.S. government. Talk with you next time.